Mark chapter 10 and verses 46 to 52. It has been said that the closest a person comes to perfection is when they fill in a job application form. Well, I don't like job application forms at all. I was pretty hopeless at school. Academically, I struggled, not least of all because I was so lazy. I was always so much more interested in playing sport than sitting in the classroom. My parents kept warning me, "You'll not make anything of yourself if you don't work hard at school." Well, I didn't work hard, and look at me now, a clergyman in the Church of England. How my parents were right. How I wish I'd listened to them. Well, believe it or not, the selection procedure to the ordination in the Church of England is quite rigorous, but still I slipped through. Copious interviews spanning about a year or so, and then a 3-day selection conference, and of course, during that whole procedure, many, many application forms to fill in. Of all the sections on application forms, and those of you who've applied for jobs will know this, I think the most difficult one is the strengths and weaknesses bit. Isn't that the most difficult of all? You see, when it comes to strengths, the strength section, well, I can find quite a few things to write, but weaknesses, I can't think of any. Well, none that I want a future employer to know about anyway. Under the weaknesses section, I always want to write filling in application forms, but I know that won't do me any good. Well, this is the bottom line. Asking about my weaknesses reveals so much about me and what I think about myself. And that's why I don't want to write them down or think about them. Good questions are always very revealing. Now, the question in our Bible passage this evening is one of those questions. Jesus asked a man called Bartimaeus in verse 51. He asked the question, "What do you want me to do for you?" It seems like a very ordinary question. It is, in fact, very revealing. Now, this was the big question of the day for Jesus. Before his meeting with Bartimaeus on that day, he'd asked two of his disciples exactly the same question. If you just flip back a page and look up to the top right-hand corner and verse 36, you'll see it there. Exactly the same question. "What do you want me to do for you?" Verse 36. Well, in so many ways, it's a very ordinary question until you consider who's asking it. You see, here is Jesus Christ, the creator of the universe, asking some ordinary men, "What do you want me to do for you?" It's completely the wrong way around, isn't it? You see, if I were God, I wouldn't be asking you what I can do for you. I'd be telling you what you can do for me, bossing you around all over the place, having you wait on me hand and foot. What a relief that I'm not God. And what a relief that Jesus Christ is. Now, in this section of the Bible, we see what separates Jesus Christ from all other religions of the world. On our honeymoon, 9.5 years ago, we went to Singapore on the way to New Zealand. We're only staying in Singapore one night and one day, and so we got up kind of bleary-eyed on the one day that we were going to be in Singapore, and we thought, what can we do for this one day? Well, we went on the city tour. They took us all over the city so that we'd say we've done Singapore. Well, one of the things they took us to was a typical temple. Now, if you've been to Singapore, you've probably seen what I saw that day as I went into the temple. Many different statues of many different gods. And everything in the temple about serving, people serving those gods. That was what the whole temple was about. People giving gifts to the gods, taking them fruits and nuts and berries. Ordinary people trying to do enough to please the gods, to appease them. Well, if you're God, of course you get people to run around all after you, to serve you. But that's not how it is with Jesus Christ. Just look at verse 45, right in the middle of those two questions that we've seen. Look at verse 45 of Mark chapter 10. "The Son of Man," says Jesus, "did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." These must be some of the most astonishing words in the Bible. "The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." This God, Jesus Christ, came to serve you and me. You'll see the phrase, "that Son of Man," there. It's a Bible phrase, a title that Jesus used more than any other to talk about himself. The Son of Man in the Bible is a figure with total authority over all creation. So how astonishing these words are. Jesus has all the power and all the authority in the world, yet he came to serve us. If you've come as a guest this evening, again, we're so pleased you've come. We know it's no small thing to come into a church. We know that you don't know what you might find here. You don't know what might happen here. Well, we hope you've been pleasantly surprised so far. You may well have come uncertain of what to expect, but I do hope you knew there was going to be a talk from the Bible. Well, I wonder what you expected to hear about the God of the Bible. Did you expect to hear about a God of demands? A God of standards? A God who lords it over men and women? That, I find, is what most people expect. Last year I spoke to a new mum about having her new baby baptised. She was a really pleasant lady. I loved talking to her. As we talked about Jesus Christ, she said this to me. I used to go to church, she said, but I stopped going because I couldn't live up to Jesus' standards. No matter how hard I tried, I could never be as good as him. You see, she saw Jesus as someone who'd given her standards to live up to. Well, from one extreme to the other, I not only talk to people about baptisms, often I have to talk to them about funerals as I take the funeral of their loved one. When we, those of us who take funerals, go to see the next of kin, we usually try to talk about the deceased to try and make the funeral as personal as possible. I can think of many occasions when I've sat down with widows talking about their husbands. And very often the widow will ask me, where is he now? And before I've even drawn breath to answer, she'll add, he always tried his best. He never did anybody any harm. He'll be in heaven, won't he? He's met God's demands, hasn't he? That's what she's saying. A God of standards, a God of demands, a God who lords it over others. Is that what you expected to hear about this evening, I wonder? Well, here's a surprise. Verse 45, the true and living God came to serve us. Does that turn things totally upside down for you? I went to church for years and I was never told this, or if I was, it never registered that Jesus, the almighty, powerful creator of the universe, came to serve us. Not to be served by us. He didn't come to be waited on hand and foot. Now this big question that we've already seen, what do you want me to do for you? This big question is part of that. And this big question that Jesus Christ puts to both Bartimaeus and to two of his followers, James and John, this big question, what do you want me to do for you, actually reveals a lot about ourselves when we answer it. Well, for someone who doesn't like being asked difficult questions, I was a complete hypocrite on Thursday lunchtime. I stood outside the church there at the door, just down the bottom of the steps, and I said to anyone passing, excuse me, may I ask you just one question, please? Now, I couldn't actually believe I was doing it, because whenever anybody tries to stop me on the street, I adopt all the avoidance techniques known to man. You know, crossing by on the other side, putting my head down or looking into my briefcase as I walk past them, making sure I don't make eye contact with them. And if all things fail, walking on purposely with a firm but polite, no thank you, not today. Do you do the same? Well, that's what I do. Well, there I was, down at the bottom of the steps, notepad in hand. Excuse me, could I ask you just one question? Well, I'm glad everybody wasn't like me. Some were prepared to stop. And so I asked them this question. If Jesus were to ask you, what do you want me to do for you, what would you say to him? Well, it was amazing the answers I got. Here are just three. One lady said to me, I'd like to win the lottery. Good answer. She said, you know, I'd really like to retire. I'm 64. I'm still having to work, but I can't afford to retire. I've got to keep working. I'd like to win the lottery. I said, thank you very much. And off she went. Another lady came along, she was with her husband, and I asked them this question, and she said, well, I'm partially sighted. I'd like my sight. It would enable me to do so much more. And then one man came along, and he said, nothing at all. I've got everything I need. I don't need anything from Jesus. Amazing. Now, if you've been unfortunate enough to have been passing by on Thursday lunchtime, how would you have answered if I'd have accosted you? If I'd have asked you the question, if Jesus were to ask you, what do you want me to do for you, how would you answer him? The way we answer tells us so much. It tells us what we think about ourselves, what we think about Jesus, and it tells us what we think our greatest need is. You see, Jesus asked this question as he was on a journey to Jerusalem, the capital of Israel. He was being followed by disciples and a large crowd of people. We're told all that in verse 46. Let me read it again for us. They came to Jericho. As Jesus, his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city, a blind man, Bartimaeus, that is, son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside begging. Now that sets the scene for us. Jesus passing through Jericho, a large crowd gathered around him, but it's someone sitting on the roadside that Mark zooms in on. Bartimaeus, a blind man, white stick by his side, cloth cap in front of him, he was begging. Maybe he had a pile of big issues to sell. Well, he would have heard the commotion as the crowd came nearer and nearer. Who knows what he was thinking? Big crowd, big issues, big payday, I don't know. Well, whatever he thought, while the crowd approached, we know how he reacted once he was in, the crowd was upon him. Look at verse 47. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. But yes, he was a blind man, but he had great insight. Bartimaeus heard that Jesus of Nazareth was coming, but he called out, verse 47, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." That is, King David, the greatest king in Israel's history. God had promised King David that one of his descendants would be the Messiah, God's ruler in God's world. Bartimaeus recognized that Jesus was the Son of David. Bartimaeus recognized that Jesus is God's king in God's world. And not only that, but Bartimaeus knew his standing before God's ruler. Do you see what he says in verse 47? "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." And again in verse 48, even though the crowd tried to shut him up, he said, "Son of David, have mercy on me. Have mercy on me." Some years ago now, when my brother was in his early 20s, he was traveling back from a week's holiday with some friends when the driver and owner of the car that he was traveling in was feeling tired and wanting a break from driving. Well, my brother offered to drive. He hadn't been driving long. He was in his early 20s, and the car for him in those days was quite a tasty car. It was a souped-up Capri. Probably most of you don't remember what a Capri is. It had spoilers, go-faster stripes, the works. Well, it seems the power under the bonnet went to my brother's head. He put his foot down, and he'd just overtaken a car on a fairly narrow road when he was pulled over by the police. The policeman walked over to him, and he said this, "Nice manoeuvre, sir." "Nice manoeuvre, sir. A reminiscent of Le Mans." "Are you any relation of Stirling Moss by any chance?" Now, for the uninitiated, Stirling Moss was arguably the greatest racing driver Britain has ever produced. And with his Stirling Moss comment, this policeman was arguably the most sarcastic policeman that the police force has ever produced as well. Well, look, my brother wasn't sure, but he knew he'd probably been speeding and possibly been driving without due care and attention. He certainly hadn't been looking out for the police car. So how should my brother react? Well, he can't appeal to the law, can he? He's probably just broken it. He's got to ask for mercy. He's at the mercy of this rather sarcastic but very witty police officer. He's at his mercy. And that's what we have to do. When we have no rights, we have to cry out for mercy. When we have no right of appeal, when we're guilty, when the other party holds all the aces, we have to cry out for mercy. And that is what Bartimaeus did. Because confronted by Jesus Christ, Bartimaeus knew he had no rights. Bartimaeus knew he was standing before one much greater than him, one much more powerful than him, God's ruler in God's world. I wonder if I can ask you this evening, is that how you treat Jesus Christ as Bartimaeus did? Do you come to him asking for mercy? Or are we like the other characters in this story, James and John, the two disciples of Jesus? We saw earlier that Jesus asked them exactly the same question that he asked Bartimaeus. It's there again in verse 36. But look at James and John's approach to Jesus. See how it compares with Bartimaeus. Look at verse 35. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to Jesus. "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do for us whatever we ask." What a difference between poor blind beggar man Bartimaeus and Jesus' two disciples, James and John. If Jesus is the Son of David, God's ruler in God's world, if Jesus is the creator of the universe, well then it's obvious who's got the right approach towards Jesus, isn't it? It's clear that James and John have got it wrong. And it's clear that James and John have far too high an opinion of themselves. When they're filling in the application form, they don't know what to put on weaknesses. See, if I'd have approached my dad like this when I was a teenager, if I'd have said to my dad, "Dad, I want you to do for me whatever I ask you to do," he'd have replied, "And I want you to go straight up to your bedroom." And if you were to treat your boss like this at work, if you were to say to your managing director or even your line manager, "I want you to do for me whatever I ask," I would think your manager would reply, "And I want you to go and collect your P45 from Human Resources." You see, it's just not right to treat those in authority over us in the way that James and John treated Jesus. It's just not right to treat the creator of the universe, God's king in God's world, this way, as James and John did in verse 35. But it's not only James and John, we do it as well. And when we do that, we show that we have far too high an opinion of ourselves. We think we're the most important person here in the universe. I have here the autobiography of Anthea Turner. I want to assure you, it's not mine. No, really, it's not mine. I borrowed it from Rico Tice. Anthea Turner writes very openly about her adulterous affair and her subsequent divorce. While she was considering leaving her husband for another man, Princess Diana was tragically killed. Well, along with millions of others, Anthea Turner says how deeply affected she was by that news. And in the light of that news, she concluded this. Life can be taken away so easily. I realise that I have to seize the day. I shouldn't waste time having an unhappy life or an unhappy marriage. I felt from then on that I had to put my needs at the top of my list of priorities. Putting my needs at the top of my list of priorities. Well, that's how I'll live if I think I'm the most important person in the universe, if I have too high an opinion of myself. And to a greater or lesser extent, that's how we all live, not just Auntie Eterna, that's how we all live, putting our needs first. It's not something we have to be taught to do either. I've got 18-month-old twins. They're an absolute delight. They, on the whole, get on very well together. But there are times when one doesn't want the other one near them, or when one has a toy that the other one wants, and then they simply march up to the other and push them. That's it. Or wrestle the toy off them. Don't have to teach children to put themselves first. Oh, when we become adults, it's far more subtle, but far more destructive. So Auntie Eterna says to herself, my needs come first. I'll marry Grant. I'll break up my marriage and my family. Because my happiness is more important than the happiness of Grant's wife, my husband, Grant's children, their grandparents, my... and so on. Now look, we may not have gone to that extent, we may not have committed adultery, but we all live life putting our needs first, don't we? That's why the world is such a miserable place. That's what James and John did. That's how James and John treated their friends. But much worse, that's how we've treated Jesus Christ, just as James and John did. Jesus, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. Setting the agenda for Jesus, well, it's not the way to treat Jesus Christ. It's not good news when I think so highly of myself, putting myself first. It's what the Bible calls sin. See, a sinful person is someone who doesn't treat Jesus as they should, as the ruler of the universe, someone who doesn't want Jesus to rule their lives. We may even believe in God and say our prayers, but when push comes to shove, we want to be in charge. We play the role of God. James and John were like that. We're all like that. And it is very destructive. You see, if I'm pretending to be God and you're pretending to be God, when we meet, who will be God? And playing God not only ruins our world, but worse still, it is a very silly game to play because it leaves us in a very great danger. A few years ago, Caroline, my wife, and I went to Canada just for a holiday for 3 weeks. It was a terrific time as we went to the Canadian Rockies. And as you enter the Canadian Rockies, you're given a leaflet like this. It says on the front of it, Vous êtes au pays des ours, which roughly translated is, you are in bear country. I know that because it says on the other side. Now, this is a very, very useful leaflet because it tells you how to cope with bear confrontations. It has a heading, exactly that, bear confrontations. And it says, despite taking all the precautions outlined in this brochure, you may still encounter a bear. They told us all the things we ought to do to avoid encountering a bear because they're very dangerous. And then it says, if you do encounter a bear, this is what you should do. The first thing, do not run. Most bears can run as fast as a racehorse. A scream or sudden movement such as running can trigger an attack. So don't run. Do listen carefully. This may save your life. I know there aren't many bears in London, but we are near the zoo. Do not run. The second thing is, after do not run, is watch the bear for aggressive behaviour. I'll read on. This includes snapping its jaws together, making a whooping sound, or keeping its head down with its ears laid back. You've got to watch for that. Next comment. Keep calm. Oh yeah, I'm sure I'm going to do that. Keep calm, assess the situation. There's no guaranteed life-saving method of coping with an aggressive bear, but calm behaviour has proven to be the most successful. And then it says, sometimes bears will bluff. Sometimes bears will bluff their way out of a threatening situation by charging and then veering away at the last second. Back away quietly, never run. Well, it's given you some important information so far as to how to cope with a bear confrontation. And then it tells you of two different bears, the grizzly bear and the black bear. And if you are attacked by a grizzly bear, it says playing dead, curling up in a ball, covering your face, neck and abdomen, may be effective. Remain still until the bear leaves the area. Fighting back usually increases the intensity of such attacks. It says of a black bear, playing dead is seldom appropriate. Try to escape to a secure place, such as a car or building, or climb up a tree. So you got the point? If you're attacked by a grizzly bear, curl up into a ball. If you're attacked by a black bear, climb up a tree. Now you've got to know which is which. And so it has a diagram, how to identify the different bears. And it says here, black bear, colour, varies from pure black to cinnamon or blonde. Very important that you know the difference between the two, black bear or grizzly bear, because you don't know what to do. So that's the black bear, grizzly bear. Colour varies from black to blonde. Well, it's obviously, After you've read this, you're not so keen to go walking, but Caroline and I did go walking in the wonderful, wonderful Canadian Rockies. It was a pretty idyllic day, the one day we went walking. We were on holiday. I was with the woman that I love. We had magnificent weather, and we had amazing views of the Canadian Rockies. And after we'd been walking for about 30 minutes, we saw a sign. A bear has been spotted in this area. Proceed with great caution. You are in danger. Amazing. We'd been walking for 30 minutes. Probably for 15 minutes of those 30 minutes, we were pretty close to this sign. We'd not felt any danger. But when we saw the sign, we knew we were. Now, whether we feel it or not, we are all in very great danger. Because whether we acknowledge it or not, we all treat Jesus as James and John treated Jesus. And when we meet Jesus Christ one day, having pushed him out of our lives or having told him what to do, we will have one almighty shock coming our way. We are in danger. Bartimaeus knew it. Bartimaeus knew he didn't have a leg to stand on. Bartimaeus knew he needed to be shown mercy. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. And Jesus did. That is exactly why he came to planet Earth, to show us mercy. That's how he serves us, in the words of verse 45. Look again at verse 45. Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus served us by giving his life as a ransom for many. The word ransom is not a word we use very often, but let me hold this book up that I read some years ago. Absolutely fascinating book. The story of John McCarthy and Jill Morell, Some Other Rainbow. John McCarthy was a journalist. He was taken hostage in Beirut. If you don't remember his name, you'll probably remember the name Terry Waite, special envoy to the Archbishop of Canterbury. He was taken hostage at about the same time that John McCarthy was taken hostage. This is a harrowing but very moving account of John McCarthy's years in captivity and Jill Morell's attempt to release him, or to see him released. You see, it seems John McCarthy had been taken hostage as a ransom. It was always assumed that at some point his captors would ask for a deal, that he would be released if some international terrorists held in Britain were released. A ransom. One life for a number of other lives. Because of the way we treat Jesus Christ in this life, after death, we face an even worse captivity than that of John McCarthy, and it was terrible. But Jesus Christ came to pay the ransom price to set us free from that. The ransom price was the ultimate price, verse 45. He gave his life as a ransom for many. One life to release many. That's how he served us. That's how he showed his mercy toward us. We don't deserve it. Think about how we treated Jesus. We don't deserve it, but Jesus loves us. When Jesus died on a cross, he was dying to serve you. Has anybody ever served you like that? Has anybody ever loved you that much? Jesus does. This is our God. Oh, you won't meet a God like this in any other religion of the world, because all the other religions of the world are man-made. And when we put ourselves on the throne, we make others serve us. So that's what we do with our gods, our man-made gods. So let me ask you, how will you respond to this astonishing God who's come to serve you? Remember when I did the survey out the front of the church and I said, if Jesus asked you, what do you want me to do for you? What would you say to him? And one man said, nothing at all. I've got everything I need. You see, at first it sounded like such a terrific answer. It is in fact the worst answer of all. Imagine that someone had given their lives as a ransom price to secure the release of John McCarthy. And then imagine that John McCarthy had decided to stay in his tiny cell rather than go free. Wouldn't that be to reject the man who'd given his life? Wouldn't it be the ultimate insult to that man who'd actually given his life? That's what you and I do when we say to Jesus, I don't need you. You may have given your life for me, but I don't need you. Nothing at all. I've got everything I need. If I won't allow Jesus to serve me like this, if I won't take this offer of forgiveness, if I reject his offer of mercy, I'm rejecting him and I will face his rejection on Judgment Day. But he doesn't want that. That's why he died for you. That's why he died for me. So when Jesus asks you the question, what do you want from me? Now we know the answer. I want you to die for me. Well, you see, he did die on a cross, but have you made it personal? When you read verse 45, do you say, I'm one of the many? When you read, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many, can you say, for me? He died for me. The blind man, Bartimaeus, is our model this evening. He cried out for mercy. He didn't think too highly of himself. He knew he deserved nothing from God's ruler. And he had great insight into who Jesus was. See, that's the thing about this chapter. The blind man can see, and those who could see were blind. The blind Bartimaeus could see who Jesus was. Those who could see, James and John, were blind to who Jesus really is. That's why they treated him so badly. We need that miracle of sight, to see who Jesus is, that he is the Messiah, God's ruler in God's world. And we need to see ourselves in the light of that. We need to see that our greatest need is the need of mercy, because we've rejected this one and bossed him around. The greatest need is we need forgiveness. Now that's what that course, Christianity Explored, is all about that was mentioned earlier. It's the course put on here by my colleague Rico Tice, and as some of you will be saying right now, you'll be saying in your heart, I really want to know this God who came to serve rather than be served. This God who would lay his life down for me, I want to know about him. Well then I want to encourage you, if that's you, to fill in the little form at the end of the service order. Just fill it in, pop it in the red box on the way out of church this evening. They're there at the door. The whole thing, you don't have to rip it off. Somebody will get in touch with you, tell you about Christianity Explored. It starts this Wednesday, 7 o'clock downstairs. Well, you can just come along. You don't actually have to fill in the form, but it would help us if you did, so that we can just be sure we know how many people are coming. Christianity Explored is a chance to discover the identity of Jesus, to find out how he paid our ransom, and to learn that even though we're more wicked than we ever realized, we're more loved than we ever dreamed. Let's pray together. Well, I'm going to leave a moment of silence as some people here will want to do business with God. And if that's you, why don't you tell him what's on your heart? Why don't you do what Bartimaeus did and call out for mercy to him? He always answers that prayer. Heavenly Father, in the light of all that we've heard this evening, help us again to understand who Jesus is, to understand in the light of that our standing before him, and to understand our greatest need, the need of mercy, the need of forgiveness, and then to run to Jesus, in whose name we ask it. Amen.